The Democrats debate in Atlanta missing in action. The lone Texans still in the race. What happened last night and what's next for Julian Castro? The story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. The impeachment inquiry taking center stage in the headlines. Though his name keeps coming up, a prominent Texan has so far managed to avoid the spotlight. Whether Rick Perry can maintain his low profile. Also, the president in Texas visiting an Apple facility as tariffs threaten to take a bite out of the company's profits. What's behind the relationship between Tim Cook and President Trump? All those stories and a whole lot more in the national news show of You Know Where. The Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 21st day of November 2019. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Amid the bustle of impeachment hearings, a Democratic debate just concluded. More on that momentarily and plenty of other news. You'd be forgiven for missing this little tidbit. Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City, yesterday filed to be on the ballot in the Democratic primary in Texas. You don't do that sort of thing if you're not serious about running for president, mind you. The Texas Tribune reports Bloomberg's strategy is a novel one, however. He plans to skip all four traditional early contests in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada, and focus his campaign on the Super Tuesday states, including the most super of them all, apparently. Seems he had enough cash to cover the $2,500 filing fee, what do you know? Interestingly enough, the only Texan in the presidential race has yet to file to put his name on the ballot. Perhaps Julian Castro is at this point conserving his resources. He has until December 9th, after all, and there are plenty of reasons to wonder whether the filing fee would be money well spent for the Castro campaign at this particular juncture. Last night, the former San Antonio mayor and HUD secretary found himself tweeting from the sidelines during the Democrats' debate in Atlanta instead of fielding questions on the big stage, his campaign not having reached the necessary threshold in the polls. So, what happened of consequence last night, and what happens to Castro? Joining us now from Atlanta, where he was covering the debate, Todd Gilman. He's Washington Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Todd, good to talk with you again, and thanks for taking a few minutes out of your morning. We appreciate it.
Sure thing. It occurred to me that Bloomberg is following in the footsteps of Rudy Giuliani, another former New York mayor. I don't need to pay attention to Iowa and New Hampshire. It'll be fine.
Hey, did anyone move the needle last night on that debate stage, as far as you can tell?
Boy, I had so many conversations with other reporters last night after the debate. We're all kind of scratching our heads. What's the lead? What's the spin on this? I'm not sure it moved the needle very much at all. Maybe it did. Maybe it will. Sometimes these things kind of move in slow motion, and as the public absorbs things, my sense of it very strongly is that nobody really cared that much about this particular debate because it is so overshadowed by the impeachment hearing, which of course came up somewhat during the debate. I thought the moderators did a pretty decent job of making sure it didn't get, you know, overwhelmed by just impeachment talk. Because if there's one thing that brings Democrats together, it's their hatred for Donald Trump and how much they think he's corrupt. But moving the needle, Joe Biden had a little gaffe here and there, and Buttigieg went on the attack and took a lot of incoming.
Well, now let me stop you right there, because you talked about Buttigieg, and of course you mean Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana. He's been said to be leading in Iowa and New Hampshire. He was taking some incoming, as you were saying, last night. How did he do in terms of sort of putting himself out there as a sort of, I don't want to say latter-day Jimmy Carter, but in a way that's the role that he seems to be playing in this field of Democratic candidates, no?
Jimmy Carter had exponentially more experience than Pete Buttigieg. I mean, not to denigrate the mayor of a city of 100,000, of which there are, I believe, 33 in Texas. But, there's still skepticism. The guy's 37, the only statewide race that he ever ran. He lost by 25 points in Indiana. He was elected mayor with just 11,000 votes. There is skepticism in the chattering classes, in the pundit classes, and certainly on stage. Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, was asked by the moderators to defend a pretty caustic comment that she had made recently about how anybody with so little experience, if they were a woman, would never have made it as far as Buttigieg had made. And she said, you know what, I pretty much, she said she stood by it because, you know, otherwise we maybe would have seen, we would have seen a woman president by now. Buttigieg turned that, obviously he's heard this kind of criticism before, and he has a whole list of ways of addressing it. You know, I have the kind of experience that really does matter.
Right.
Have good judgment. Judgment is more important than experience. Right. So he, you know, he pivoted. He kind of jujitsued, well, if you're going to attack my experience, I'm going to attack your judgment.
Todd, we have just a few seconds, but you've been in Atlanta most of this week. Secretary Julian Castro also there. Last night, he was tweeting away. What's next for him?
That's a good question. How long he can hang on? He failed to qualify for this debate. He almost certainly won't qualify for the December debate in Los Angeles about a month from now. He was very cleverly using Twitter to attract attention, and in the context of a debate that didn't have any, you know, major sizzling, wow, breakout moments for anybody, his running commentary on Twitter actually did pretty well. But without the national spotlight of debates, with very little money, he remains polling below 1% in all of the national polls. He's not making a breakout in any of the early states, even in Texas. He's, you know, by any traditional measure, he is in trouble. And whether he can limp through Iowa and New Hampshire, where he has no big support, how he can even survive to the Texas primary is a mystery.
Todd Gilman, Washington Bureau Chief of the Dallas Morning News. Todd, good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Sure thing.
The Three Amigos. That sounds like something Rick Perry might be involved in somehow. You might be onto something. Indeed, the former Texas governor and outgoing energy secretary is one of a trio of people tasked to oversee U.S. relations with Ukraine, according to George Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the EU. In testimony to House impeachment investigators yesterday, Sondland identified himself, Perry, and another U.S. diplomat, Kurt Volker, as the Three Amigos. By whatever name, what investigators really want to know is if the three were instructed to put pressure on Ukraine's president to investigate President Trump's political rival Joe Biden in exchange for U.S. military aid, a so-called quid pro quo. Here to talk about what we've learned, Rebecca Dean, the chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Texas Arlington. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
What were the implications against former governor, former energy secretary Perry, that Sondland brought up in his testimony, from what you can tell?
Well, it sure seems like Sondland suggests that Rudy Giuliani tasked both he and Rick Perry and Volker as the folks who would sort of lead this charge on what the president wanted with regard to Ukraine.
Was Sondland acknowledging that he was actually brought in as part of this trio, if you will? Or I mean, was that what you understood Sondland to say?
That is what I understood him to say, and that I think the important part of this is that he traces the breadcrumbs all the way back to the president. So he suggests that the president tasked Mayor Giuliani, who then pulled in these three folks to lead the charge.
When we say lead the charge, a lot has been made of the phrase quid pro quo. Is this the smoking gun that there was a quid pro quo, to mix up these popular expressions?
Right, the metaphors.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think the Democrats have tried to make the argument that this is, you know, very analogous to the John Dean testimony in the Nixon impeachment hearings, that this will be the thing that ties most directly to the president. And the Democrats are really trying to suggest that this is something larger than simply the infamous phone call, and that the interests of the president, the desires of the president to use foreign policy toward Ukraine, toward this personal political goal, is really the point. That it's not about only whether there was an exchange of, if you announce investigations, we'll give you this meeting, or if you announce investigations, we'll give you this money. Mm-hmm. The Democrats are trying to suggest that it's the whole picture.
The Department of Energy responded yesterday saying Sondland's testimony was a misrepresentation of Perry's activity with regard to Ukraine. What has Perry's formal response been to these allegations?
It's been all through his aides, both for he and for the vice president, whom Sondland also implicated as having knowledge of the plans, of the big picture plans.
Well, do you think it's going to be hard for Perry at this point to avoid publicly testifying? Because so far, he's pretty much ignored the subpoenas.
And he's not alone in ignoring the subpoenas. Frankly, I don't really expect he or those close to the president, Mick Mulvaney or Mayor Giuliani, to testify unless a court compels them to do so.
What would you consider to be the main takeaways as we round the corner on the these public hearings? I think today's is the last scheduled hearing. Anything you're looking for in particular?
I guess the things that are that we don't expect, right? So I think that Sondland gave us more direct and damning language than perhaps was expected. I think that some of the earlier testimony gave details that fleshed things out. And I would expect today to hear about whether or not it was Ukraine or Russia. So Fiona Hill, I think, is going to testify really throwing darts at the Republicans' argument that perhaps it was Ukraine that interfered in the 2016 election. And she's going to say very decisively, no, it was Russia.
Rebecca Dean is chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Texas at Arlington. She's been following this story closely. Professor, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
Joining us once again in the studio, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. Another day, another hearing on Capitol Hill. As y'all were just talking about, we're keeping a watchful eye on reactions to today's impeachment hearing, the third and final one this week. Those perspectives later in the show. For now, we're hearing from our friends and listeners about last night's Democratic presidential debate and one Julian Castro's reaction to not making it on the stage and the way he played that, live tweeting his reactions to those questions. Via Twitter, Real World 2018 tells us that Castro needs to call it a day, put those resources behind another candidate. And on our Facebook page, Liz Ulrich says, moving forward, the debates need more Julian, less Tulsi Gabbard. And I have to say, Gabbard's performance garnering more reactions online. Leah Keese on our Facebook page as well. She says, this is the third time in a debate Gabbard has gone after people viciously. After she called Buttigieg too cowardly to sit down with foreign leaders, I'm totally done with her. And Dallas Hall says this about the debates overall. Can we whittle it down to the top four already? Good question there. And it's interesting to see how people really having trouble sort of breaking out of the pack, although I guess there hasn't been any new polling since last night's debate, so maybe a little premature. Who knows?
I was just thinking, yeah, let's see, whittling it down to the top four. Huh. I wonder who those four would be. Y'all already all on the same page, right? Hey, we need to hear from you, Texas. Tweet us, won't you, at Texas Standard. Wells back in 35 with more of your comments. This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Here's some truth for you. If there were any doubt that Houston's Lizzo is the unquestioned queen of this particular moment in pop, this should put any of those lingering doubts to rest. Nominees for the 2020 Grammy Awards were announced yesterday, and Lizzo is up for 8 different awards, more than any other artist. Bling, bling, then I saw them, that's the goddess in me. You could have had a bad, not committal. Help you with your career, just a little. Categories include Album of the Year, Record of the Year, where fellow Texans Khalid and Post Malone are also nominated, and Best New Artist, where Austinites will recognize another nominee. Eric Burdon and Adrian Quesada, the soul duo better known as Black Pumas, also earned a nod in the Best New Artist category. Their self-titled debut album came out earlier this year, and should they win, well, they won't be the first nominees with Texas ties to take home the award. I kind of grease in the fulcrum of your inner space that you'll think you've got yours and I've got mine. sometimes Austinite full-time bassist and vocalist Esperanza Spalding won the prize in 2011. This year, her album 12 Little Spells is nominated for Best Jazz Vocal Album, as is Love and Liberation, the most recent record from Dallasite Jasmia Horn. Jazz is just one of the styles with multiple Texan nominees, though. Best Gospel Album includes two Texans, Fort Worth's Kirk Franklin and Houston's Gene Moore, who we're hearing from now. You'll also find two Texas groups nominated for Best Regional Mexican Album, La Energia Norteña and Intocable, and three for Best Blues Albums, Delbert McClinton and Jimmy Vaughn in the traditional category, and Sugar Ray Rayford in contemporary. Two well-known names took two nominations each, Gary Clark Jr. and Beyoncé. And, of course, we'd be remiss not to mention the Texans nominated in the country music categories. Maren Morris was nominated for a song she cut with fellow high woman Brandi Carlile, but Tanya Tucker leads the country pack with four nods, including Best Country Song for Bring My Flowers Now.
Bring my flowers now while I'm living. I won't need your love when I'm gone.
Competing with her in that category is East Texas's own Miranda Lambert. And last but certainly not least, Willie Nelson received a nomination for Best Country Solo Performance for his song Ride Me Back Home, the title track from the Redheaded Strangers' 69th studio album.
I wish I could gather up all of your brothers and you would just ride me back home.
The winners will be announced on January 26th on CBS.
Ride me back home to a much better place. Blue skies and sunshine and plenty of space. Somewhere where they would just leave you alone. Somewhere that you could call home. And you would just ride me back home.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. This week, Verizon announced it's launching 5G networking for mobile devices to Houston. The company, along with rival Sprint and AT&T, have already rolled out small-scale 5G offerings for home and business internet access, but this week's announcement marks a major push to provide cell phone users in a total of 18 cities, with 12 more expected by year's end. Our tech expert Omar Gayaga has been watching these 5G rollouts, and he's here to tell us what mobile 5G is all about and why Houston's becoming something of a 5G magnet. Hey there, Omar. Omar?
Hey, David.
You can say my name twice, too. Omar. we've talked about 5G networking before. Tell us a little bit again how it's different from what's available to most of us now.
Yeah, most of us with smartphones use 4G LTE, which, you know, is plenty fast for certain things. You know, it can go up to, I think, 400 megabits per second, which is pretty speedy. But this next generation, 5G, combines several kinds of wireless technologies to make even faster connections, something like 10 to 20 times faster. So this, you know, gigabit internet, that was a huge wave for home use. You'd get those speeds on your cell phone out and about. So there are some limitations to 5G. It requires a lot of smaller points of technology, a lot of smaller devices rolled out into a city to provide that access. It's much shorter range. And also there's some issues with that it works much better out in the open than indoors.
I see what you're saying. Well, here's the thing about 5G, and I think the hype that has sort of been attached to it. AT&T came out with a phone that sort of said that it had 5G, but then they sort of backtracked and said, well, we don't actually say it has 5G. Well, it was flashing 5G on the freaking handset. So, I think a lot of folks have not noticed much of a speed bump there. If you're using one of these Verizon handsets in parts of Houston and you don't see that sudden speed bump, like, wow, you know, this is really, really, really different. I wonder if a lot of the air, a lot of the excitement about the 5G rollout is going to kind of out of the tires here at some point.
Yeah, it kind of feels like a big celebration and rollout for something that most people aren't going to be able to use for a while until they get new phones that can even do this. Verizon says it has 7 handsets that are 5G capable, including some of the newer Samsung Galaxy phones. But there's not an iPhone in existence that can do this yet. That 5G light that you see is really more of a 4G LTE kind of speed boost. So it's going to require people to upgrade their phones to these newer phones that can do this, and also for it to be widespread enough. Right now in Houston, it's still limited to specific areas like the Galleria area, downtown, the uptown area. And some of the big stadiums, which is actually, I think, the real story here is that it's really geared toward being able to provide more bandwidth and lower latency at big events like football games or, concerts. So to that end, in Houston, you've got, the NRG Stadium, BBVA, Compass Stadium, Rice Stadium, the Galleria, places where lots of people are going to be gathering, and they can really take advantage of that, those higher speeds.
But it's not just the cell phones. Are we going to have to pay extra for 5G service?
Well, yeah, none of this is free. I mean, all of this infrastructure and rollout costs a lot of money. And Verizon users who are on unlimited and are going to be doing this are already seeing like a $10 fee added to their bill. So this is probably not going to be free for most people.
All right. So why Houston? Why? I mean, Austin's got a lot of early adopters. I know that. And Dallas certainly could use it, too. Why is Houston getting this 5G rollout early?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, that we had these smaller wireless access points that have to be rolled out in order to enable this. And Houston was one of the friendlier municipalities to allow these wireless companies to install those. Austin actually kind of dropped the ball on this and made it a little bit harder for them to do that, to kind of roll out these smaller devices. So they kind of lagged behind on that. So Houston has actually been a little bit friendlier toward the wireless companies as far as rolling out those transmitters.
You think this is going to be as revolutionary as people say it will be? I mean, I remember when the Segway was talked about as revolutionary. So, I mean, what do you think?
I think it's going to kind of meet those expectations where people are used to faster speeds at home, where if they have a gigabit internet, if they have Google internet service that does those higher speeds, they're going to want that same kind of experience when they're outside the home. So I think it's going to kind of match that. But until we see these applications that really take advantage of these speeds, that really do something with it, it's going to be a while before people really see the difference if all they're doing is uploading photos or browsing Instagram.
Yeah. Omar Gayaga, you can read all about it at techminutetexas.com, and we'll talk again in a couple of weeks. Omar, great to talk with you. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving if I don't talk to you till then.
You too, David. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. An environmental group is taking the first step in a massive lawsuit against the Trump administration to try to secure federal protections for nearly 300 imperiled plants and animals, dozens of which live in Texas. The Center for Biological Diversity filed a formal notice Wednesday of its intent to sue. Michael Robinson, their senior conservation advocate, says the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has failed to make timely decisions about whether species are eligible for protection under the Endangered Species Act. That includes a turtle in Texas, the Rio Grande cooter.
And we believe the Rio Grande cooter urgently needs protection. And it's been waiting since 2012 when we filed a scientific petition to protect it.
Robinson says Texas provides no protections for the Rio Grande cooter, and it is hunted in the state. He adds the turtle is also facing habitat loss due to pollution. SpaceX says it is moving forward after its Starship prototype suffered a catastrophic failure during a test at its Boca Chica launch pad in South Texas. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav reports.
Video captured yesterday by area residents shows the stainless steel pillar erupting, shooting off the top of the test vehicle, and billowing white gas from what many speculate is liquid oxygen. According to SpaceX, no one was hurt in the explosion, and the test was to pressurize the vehicle to the max. The vehicle that SpaceX CEO Elon Musk stood in front of in late September as he talked about the company's plans for going back to the moon and other extraterrestrial exploration appears to have been severely damaged. The company says it is not a serious setback, and in a tweet, Musk said the failure had value as a manufacturing pathfinder, and they would move on to their next version of the spaceship. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
The Department of Defense today announced the deaths of two soldiers with ties to Texas. Both soldiers killed in Afghanistan Wednesday were assigned to the 1st Cavalry Division at Fort Hood. Chief Warrant Officers Kirk Fujigami Jr. and David Nadel died in a helicopter crash while protecting ground troops in Logar Province. 33-year-old Nadel was from Tarrant County, Texas. Officer Fujigami was 25 and from Hawaii. And in the next hour, an unaccompanied veteran will be buried in Killeen. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner has more.
Unaccompanied veteran burials are for veterans with no known family. So today, A.R. Lewis Adkins Jr., who served in the U.S. Navy, will receive military honors at the Central Texas State Veterans Cemetery. The Texas Veterans Land Board is encouraging people in Central Texas to come and, quote, ensure no veteran is ever left behind.
That's Sasha Cordner reporting. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Well, you may have heard President Donald Trump made his way to the capital city of Texas yesterday, touring a facility that builds computers for Apple. Mr. Trump met with Apple CEO Tim Cook while touring the place. Cook took the opportunity to also announce the groundbreaking of a $1 billion, 3 million square foot Apple campus, one that's expected to initially employ 5,000 people. But the visit also comes at a time when the Trump administration is in a trade war with China, where we should point out billions of dollars of Apple imports come from. Jordan Fabian has been writing about all this for Bloomberg News. He's White House correspondent for Bloomberg. Jordan, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Let me first talk about what seemed to be a rather cordial relationship between the president and Tim Cook, one that might seem not very logical, given that Apple's been sort of taking a beating in this trade war, as I understand it. No?
Yeah, that's right. And to head some of that off, Apple CEO Tim Cook has worked over the last couple of years to really build a close personal relationship with the president. You know, unlike other tech executives who have clashed with the president, thinking of Jack Dorsey of Twitter and Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, Cook has had dinner with the president at his private golf club in New Jersey. He's built a relationship with his daughter Ivanka, who's also a senior advisor in the White House, and all of this with the aim of trying to get the Trump administration to exempt Apple from some of these tariffs that the U.S. is putting on imports from China.
Is there any sign that he's winning in this diplomatic game?
Yes, it certainly paid dividends for Apple. The company asked for a first round of tariff exemptions a few months back over the summer, and they won 10 out of 15. And when Apple announced that it was going to be assembling the Mac Pro down in Austin, they cited those tariff exemptions as a major reason why they were able to do it. And now Apple's asking for a second round for a new round of tariffs that's gone into place in September for parts for the iPhone, AirPods, etc. And the president down there speaking at the factory in Austin said that he's exploring those exemptions.
Well, perhaps this should be this is a sort of a window into how you correct me if I'm wrong, how one works with this administration. You develop a one-on-one relationship with Donald Trump as best one can.
Absolutely. And this is a lesson that not only big business CEOs have learned, but also foreign leaders, thinking of, you know, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who's, you know, played golf with the president,
right.
Made some hats with Make America Great Again style hats. So, yes, certain savvy business and world leaders have learned that the key to winning some favors from the Trump administration is building a relationship with the president himself.
Jordan, I don't know if you caught this, but it seemed like the president had it in his head that he was opening this new facility for the construction of the Mac Pro. Did you catch on to that?
Yeah, he said that down there in a tweet this morning. He sort of implied that, you know, I opened this facility, but that facility's been open for a few years now. It was assembling the old model of Mac Pro starting in 2013, and of course, you know, Apple announced some new investments late last year. And, you know, as we know, the president sort of likes to take credit for these kind of announcements that are made by private companies, trying to paint them as part of his jobs agenda, even if they're completely independent of that.
How much of Apple's production is going to be done here in the United States versus how much of it's going to be done overseas? Still, most of it, I would imagine, still being done in China.
All the final assembly for these products are the vast majority is happening in China, and that's why the company is so desperately trying to avoid these tariffs, because they know if they go into place, especially the round that might come in the winter, if this so-called phase one deal with China doesn't happen, the cost of their products are going to go way up, and the margins for Apple could go down.
You know, I was trying to figure out something here. Is when I first heard the story that Trump was going to be coming to Austin, this was just, about a month after he went to North Texas for the Louis Vuitton plant opening. I think the leather factory there. So that's twice in as many months. Do you think that part of this was, it wasn't just about celebrating industries that are, doing things, building things in Texas, making things in Texas, or in the United States for that matter, but that President Trump is a little concerned about how he's doing in the Lone Star State per se?
I think certainly these trips are happening with an eye toward his 2020 reelection race. And you said it there. There's some concern that Texas may be going slightly in the Democrats' direction, although this has been said over the past two or three election cycles now. We haven't seen that happen yet. But I think that the campaign has had its eye on Texas, and this is from discussions I've had with campaign officials. They're eyeing Texas. They still think it's in their corner, but the fact that the president is spending time there is a sign that they want to shore it up. And going down to a place like an Apple facility or a Louis Vuitton plant, they can cut that into a 15-second campaign ad and say that the president's creating jobs, et cetera, and it's happening right there down in Texas.
Jordan Fabian is White House correspondent for Bloomberg. Jordan, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it. Thanks.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm Marika Flatt, travel editor with Texas Lifestyle Magazine, here with your weekend trip tip. If you've got a long weekend coming up or you'd like to take a vacation but don't want to book a flight, consider a Texas road trip. We know Texas is a big state and can be overwhelming to choose where to go, but we've put together a sample itinerary through three cities with enough to see and do to make your journey one to remember. The connecting factor here is the presence of luxury boutique hotels by a Houston-based Valencia Hotel Group. The group's collection includes big hotels, like one on San Antonio's Riverwalk, but also smaller offerings, like a new 165-room hotel coming to Lubbock and featuring outdoor porches with rocking chairs. That one is set to open next summer. For our road trip, we'll start in Irving, where you can find the Texican Court. It was inspired by the movie The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. It has a retro feel to it, much like the roadside hotels of the 50s and 60s. But don't let the vintage vibe fool you. This hotel is full of modern amenities. You might overlook Irving as just a suburb of Dallas, but since the 1960s, Irving has been transforming its oil fields into a thriving community full of Texas charm. Irving is the only place in Texas where you can get an authentic Venetian gondola ride. Miles of canals wind through residential, restaurant, and shopping districts. It's also home to the largest equestrian sculpture in the world and the Ruth Payne Museum, where Lee Harvey Oswald slept and stowed his gun the night before he shot President John F. Kennedy. Next, pack up the car and head about 3 hours south to College Station. Here you'll find Calvary Court, located in Century Square. The hotel pays homage to Aggie history with its decor and barrack style. Guests will enjoy outdoor fire pits, as well as large and beautifully appointed rooms. And even if you're not a fan of the Texas A&M Aggies, you might appreciate the history of a behind-the-scenes tour of Kyle Field. You can learn about the famous 12th man, get access to places usually only reserved for athletes and coaches. And while you're on campus, head over to the somber yet beautiful Bonfire Memorial and consider a tour of the George H.W. Bush Presidential Library. When you're hungry, stop in at the famous Dixie Chicken for some Southern fare. And then step outside to check out Bottle Cap Alley. Generations of students have lined the alleyway with bottle caps from both beer and sodas. Perfect for an Instagram shot. And another good eatery is the headquarters of Grub Burger Bar. Their burgers and hand-spun spike shakes never disappoint. From College Station, head to the state capitol. The Lone Star Court in Austin's Domain Shopping Center also has a retro vibe. Enjoy a drink outside or roast some marshmallows after dinner. The hotel's location in the Domain makes it very walkable to eat, drink, and enjoy North Austin entertainment. Sites worth visiting in Austin include the Blanton Museum, home of the Alejandro Diaz Make Tacos Not War sculpture, and the Ellsworth Kelly exhibit. Take a stroll down South Congress Avenue, where you'll find Texas-sized shopping opportunities and more Tex-Mex than you can possibly eat. That's your weekend trip tip. I'm Marika Flatt for the Texas Standard.
Marika Flatt is travel editor for Texas Lifestyle Magazine. You can find more of her weekend trip tips at texasstandard.org. Texas lawmakers gave a huge boost to public education this year with a $6 billion increase in funding, but only a small portion of that money went to improve special education, something Texas is under federal orders to fix. Houston Public Media's Laura Isensee has been exploring how to focus money toward student needs.
Let's start in West Houston with Tab and Mid-Aga and their kids. There's Jenna, who's 7.
And then this is my son, Ayan. He is 4. He has autism. And he loves numbers.
Aga joins his son on the living room floor to solve a number puzzle.
That's 12. 12.
The thing about Ayan is, like, although he has, like, limitations with, like, communication and speech, like,
four.
He can do really complex,
number
like,
14,
big puzzles.
Number 14.
Yes, number 14.
Ayan attends pre-kindergarten with children of all abilities. At Neff Early Learning Center in Houston, his dad says kids with disabilities aren't segregated in their own classrooms.
Yeah, these children have special needs, but they're learning from their peers. But then their peers are also gaining leadership qualities that they might not otherwise, you know, gain from another place.
Ayan's mom, Mid-Aga, says the other 4-year-olds really care about her son, like when Ayan was out sick.
When he came back, his backpack was full of notes saying, "Oh, Ayan, we miss you. Oh, Ayan, we love you," and drawings of the kids. So it's amazing.
It is amazing. And in Texas, rare. All-inclusive schools like this are hard to run, in part because of how the state pays for special ed. Schools get more money if children with disabilities are separated, and less money for integrated classrooms like Ayan's. If it sounds like Texas has a problem with how it pays for special ed, federal judges on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals would agree. They've blasted Texas for creating what they call a perverse incentive for the state to escape its financial obligations. Stephen Alamon is with Disability Rights Texas.
It was shockingly harsh and quite, however, satisfying that the Fifth Circuit recognized that we have a structural problem in our school finance system with regard to students with disabilities.
He says one issue is Texas has barely changed its method for special ed funding in over 20 years. Only one of those formulas got an update this year. Instead of small tweaks, Alamon says Texas needs to focus funding on students' needs, not where they learn.
We have sort of put our finger in the dike and stopped the leak, but whether the whole dam is going to collapse is still a potential problem we're going to have to deal with.
Can we do more? Absolutely. So don't bring in the Fifth Court.
That's state representative Dan Huberty.
I really don't care what they say because we're going to fix it the right way.
The Republican from Humble led school finance reform this legislative session. Huberty says schools now get more money for some children with disabilities and those with dyslexia. And that should be a start.
We just put $11.5 billion into the system. I want to see better results.
But Santrice Jones, the principal at Neff Early Learning Center, says that money doesn't help pay extra staff for inclusive classrooms.
To be very transparent, I penny pinch a lot.
The first thing that I do when I'm setting up my budget is I look at my personnel.
Then Jones gets creative and looks for outside donations. She says it's worth it because research shows kids with disabilities generally do better when they're included. And Ayan's parents have seen that. Mid-August says it's setting the tone for her son's future.
If you're not including people with disability, once they become adults, they're going to be seen as the others.
She wishes more Texas students could have the same opportunity her son does, but it's going to take more funding changes from the state. In Houston, I'm Laura Eisensee for the Texas Standard.
San Antonio-based HEB says it will send at least 3 truckloads of produce, meats, and dry goods to the Houston Food Bank. This after the food bank had to trash almost 2 million pounds of refrigerated food. Houston Chronicle reports the food was contaminated by an ammonia leak after a fan broke in a storage room. Fort Worth-based United Airlines is also stepping up. They've announced a campaign to support the food bank, pledging to match up to $100,000 in individual donations. Coming up on 49 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. There's more of the Standard just ahead. Stay with us. This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. 2 former Houston police officers now face federal criminal charges for a botched raid last January that left 2 people dead. Also charged in federal court, a female 911 caller alleged to have provided phony information that led to the raid in the first place. For months, the Houston Chronicle has been detailing what actually happened during this raid and the subsequent investigations in both state district court and now in federal court. Reporter Kerry Blakinger is here to talk about the latest developments. Kerry, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Both of the officers involved in this raid have been fired, right? So they are now no longer HPD. Who are they and what exactly have they been charged with by the feds?
Well, so first of all, they retired. They resigned under investigation much earlier in the year before they were actually criminally charged with anything. And right now, the officers, case agent Gerald Goines and his longtime partner, Stephen Bryant, are part of a 9-count indictment with the feds. They already had state charges, and now the feds have added on a variety of charges, things like witness tampering and falsifying records.
But as I understand it, there's some civil rights charges against them as well.
2 of those 9 are for violating rights of the couple that was killed in the raid. One of those charges mentions the man, Dennis Tuttle, and the other mentions the woman, Regina Nicholas. But the other 7 counts of the indictment are things like witness tampering and falsifying records.
There's a third person who has been named by the feds, and this was a 911 caller. Why was this individual charged?
So the whole thing started when a woman called 911. I think it was earlier that month, but it was, you know, shortly before the raid at any rate. When she called 911 to say that her daughter was in the home doing drugs, that, you know, Dennis and Regina were smoking crack and that there were guns, including machine guns. And none of that turned out to be true. And that was the basis for the decision to go, I would say investigate, but I guess they didn't investigate, you know, but to, you know, look into it further. And when Goines and Bryant, air quotes here, investigated, they, you know, allegedly did not investigate and instead, you know, have, according to the, you know, state's theory here, have fabricated an informant, lied on the affidavit that they used to get a search warrant, and then, you know, raided, all of which stems from this initial 911 call.
Now we should be clear about something. This was not just any raid where you knock on the door and you say police. This was a no-knock raid.
Right. So that is something that, you know, HPD and many departments have been commonly using in any situation where they can show that there may be a gun inside the home, or even simply that it may be easy to dispose of the drugs if you just politely knock and ask to come in. So sometimes we'll see the justification with things like, oh, we think the drugs are kept near the toilet and they might flush them, so we need to do a no-knock. So when they do a no-knock, they come in, you know, all suited up, you know, guns blazing, and pound down the door.
But this can wind up to be a bloodbath, as it has in many cases. In fact, in some jurisdictions, no-knock raids are absolutely prohibited. And what I'm wondering here, did they find a large cache of weapons or large cache of drugs?
They did not find a large cache of drugs, certainly. They found small user-level amounts of marijuana and cocaine when, what they said they were expecting to find was heroin dealers. So they were expecting to find a large amount of heroin. They found, user-level amounts of other drugs. And then in terms of guns, they did say that they recovered some guns, but no machine guns. And there's been no indication that they were illegal.
Was there anything else that you learned yesterday that was new based on your reporting of this story so far?
Well, I mean, to me, the big thing was learning the identity of this 911 caller, because we'd been trying to get the 911 audio tape, and this had been a source of mystery, because we knew that it was someone who lived nearby, and we knew the general contents of the call, but we did not know who it was specifically. And it was really interesting to see that they actually charged this person, because, I mean, to me, this leaves a lot of unanswered questions in terms of what her motive was for doing this, how this all came about.
Kerry Blakinger covers criminal justice for the Houston Chronicle. Kerry, thanks again for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Let's find out what social media is buzzing about. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. Heard about this one just a little while ago in the show, President Donald Trump's trip to Texas yesterday to promote tech behemoth Apple and its decision to keep manufacturing its Mac Pro computer in the Texas capital city, continuing to generate a lot of reactions. A little bit of a circus greeting the president. I don't know if you saw their images of conspiracy theorist Alex Jones walking along the sort of like makeshift parade route in this kind of armored vehicle looking thing. A lot of protesters against the president, and a lot of supporters as well. So people continuing to chime in about all that on our Facebook page. Joshua Congleton says the president basically came here to lie and take pictures. He cites a Trump tweet. The president did tweet yesterday evening, "Today I opened a major Apple manufacturing plant in Texas."
Wait a minute. He said he opened a manufacturing?
Yes. I think, as we noted yesterday and probably and earlier in the show, that plant been manufacturing Apple products for several years. It's my understanding.
It's a contractor, too.
Not an actual plant. But the president essentially taking credit for it. Michelle Vansel Osborne says, "I'm tickled that he had to come to the most liberal city in Texas for a photo op. However, Tom Cripps is supporting the president. He says, it warms my heart to see Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, and the associates of Apple giving our president a welcome greeting, affirming that his America First policies are indeed making America great again." Lots of comments being generated about that sort of, I guess you could call it almost a marriage of convenience between Tim Cook and Donald Trump there. Because, Apple, California-based, gay CEO there, progressive on a bunch of social issues, but still very tight with the president when it comes to this, and possibly, people speculating over the sort of tax ramifications and the economic impact that Donald Trump's tax cuts have had for companies like Apple.
It's interesting because President Trump has maintained this sort of bilateral posture when it comes to his international relations, and it seems like that's probably the best policy when it comes to dealing with President Trump, too, and that's something that we were discussing a little bit earlier. You have to have that that one-on-one relationship with the commander-in-chief.
It's the art of the deal, if you will, David.
You might say that. Yeah, you might.
Speaking of wheeling and dealing, more debates coming in to the more reactions coming into that debate last night between all the Democratic would-be Democratic presidential candidates. Eric Stewart, for him, the big takeaway was Biden's huge gaffe. The one where he forgot about Kamala Harris being a senator. I don't know if you saw that towards the end of the debate.
I didn't see that part, no.
Biden was citing his bona fides within the African-American community, saying he had the endorsement of the only African-American woman elected to the Senate. neglecting to recall that another African woman elected to the Senate, Kamala Harris, was standing on the same stage with him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little bit of reaction. And you know, that just the remarkable news about Julian Castro, he had his best fundraising day yesterday.
Isn't that kind of amazing?
And he wasn't even on the debate stage.
Well, he was really working the Twitter during the debate, that's for sure. Hey, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here tomorrow with more news about Texas, about Texans, and the like. Keep your comments coming to Texas Standard. We'll be back tomorrow. Hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.